Beth Fratkin is joining me. This is Larry Warren, and welcome to Mountain Money.
On the second half of the show, we'll be talking to Joe Dobro. He's the author of Natural Profits, From Health Food to Whole Foods, How the Pioneers of the Industry Changed the Way We Eat and Reshaped American Business. So that's a pretty interesting story about how the hippies that just wanted to promote good eating and sunshine and healthy food turned into whole food.
And now the hippies are corporate conglomerates.
Yes, yes. So this will be a good conversation. We're looking forward to talking to him.
Just because it's white outside doesn't mean you can't stay green.
Listen to This Green Earth every Tuesday at 9 a.m.
Discussing environmental issues from methane gas to moose habitat.
Air quality to fire ecology.
And bark beetles to eating bugs.
That's This Green Earth, brought to you by
Republic Services,
Habitat for Humanity's Restore, Jones, Waldo, Holbrook, and McDonough.
Good morning. Welcome back to Mountain Money. You're listening to KPCW 91.9 FM. We're just about to have a conversation with Joe Dobro. He's the author of Natural Profits, From Health Foods to Whole Foods, How the Pioneers of the Industry Changed the Way We Eat and Reshaped American Business. Are you on the line there, Joe?
I am, Beth. Good morning.
Good morning. Nice to talk to you.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be with you, too. Thanks for having me on.
So can you give us an idea of your background before we start talking about the subject of your book?
Yeah, absolutely. I have spent most of my career as a marketing executive in the natural foods industry. So I spent a number of years as the head of marketing for Whole Foods Market and for one of its predecessor companies. And then a couple of stops in between, but more recently with a company that some of your listeners might be familiar with called Sprouts Farmers Market, which has rapidly grown into the second largest retailer in the natural foods industry. And they've got a few locations in Salt Lake City at this point. So, yeah, most of my career has been spent peddling tofu one way or another.
Well, why don't we start with the question of when did foods become unnatural and why?
That's a good question. And it really was an astonishingly fast turnaround because if you think back, really within our accessible lifetimes, when our grandparents were in their primes, all food was natural and organic. We just didn't call it that. But what happened was that just at the end of World War II, when all of the gearworks and the material that had been used to create the war machine needed a new use, much of it got converted to agriculture. And so in a heartbeat, evolutionarily speaking, we went from this world of natural and organic to one that was synthetic and unnatural. And very quickly you had the release of DDT as initially a military tool to become an agricultural one. It became very quickly the most popular pesticide in the country. And on its heels you had the development of 80,000 new chemical compounds and about 5,000 new food additives. So it was really in the space of, I would say, less than two decades after World War II in which we saw that pendulum swing from all natural and organic to no natural and organic.
And then can you trace a decline of health or an increase in certain types of heart problems to the growing unnaturalness of processed foods? I mean, has it proven to that we now have food that hurts us when we eat it?
You know, it's a controversial question because for every answer that points to one study saying yes, there are direct linkages there, there's probably another study that points to the opposite answer. But I don't think that anybody who is a logical thinker can look at what has happened in the world today, especially in this country, with the rapid increase in food allergies that did not exist, or at least were largely unheard of when we were kids, or look at the obesity epidemic, or look at the rates of cancer and heart disease and things like that, and not somehow connect the dotted lines back to what has happened in the food industry. You know, that old saying, you are what you eat. And I think at this point, what we are is kind of indeterminate, because there's so many chemicals that have entered the human body and have changed us evolution. An amazing fact, but true, is newborns now, on average, have 232 traces of chemicals in their systems.
Yeah, that...
They haven't ingested any food yet. Yeah. But there's 232 chemicals in their systems.
Yeah, that's a tragedy, I think, from any point of view. But let's go back and talk about, you know, after the war and when this trend started accelerating, there were a few farmers and people that were devoted to raising alarms about this, but it really didn't pick up steam, the natural foods area or product line, until the 60s, when all these hippies decided that, you know, they wanted to eat tofu.
Back to nature.
It was like when I first started buying food on my own, I wouldn't have been caught dead going into a natural food store unless I was wearing patchouli oil and was half stoned. You know, so how did we get from there to the situation where we're in now, where people are, you know, Whole Foods is one of the fastest growing companies in the country?
Yeah. Well, that's really the story of my book, of Natural Profits, because what happened was, you had this generation born in the first wave of the baby boom, right at the end of World War II, up into the mid-50s, that as they came of age, they just, as a matter of compunction, sort of naturally rejected the business world around them. And there had been so much change in food and in farming, and in the way that Madison Avenue was writing catchy jingles to get us to eat Mounds bars and drink Coke and what have you, that this generation really started to rebel against that. The problem was that they really had no infrastructure with which to do that, because all that existed at that point were a scattering of backwater health food stores and some isolated farms and, as you were saying, Beth, just some really weird products. You know, the co-ops and the health food stores of that era were really small. They always had these wood flat floors and bins full of bulk brown rice or peanut butter or honey and Asian products that nobody had ever heard of. And the fruit was terrible. In fact, there's a chapter in the book called "A Few Gnarly Pieces of Produce," and that's really the description of what the organic fruit looked like in that day. So this group of people, and this included folks like Mo Siegel, who went on to become the founder of Celestial Seasonings Tea, or Gene Kahn, who created Cascadian Farm, or John Mackey, who was the co-founder of Whole Foods Market, as they came up through this era, they began to recognize that there was some real business potential out there, and that if somehow you could begin to focus the capital and professionalize the merchandising and expand the size of the stores and of the supply side, that there were lots of people out there who would potentially have interest in this.
Yeah, and you write about the Boulder Mafia, and that's where Celestial Seasonings grew from, Mo Siegel. Why don't you briefly tell his story?
Yeah, Larry, there's a great story about Mo Siegel. He was born in the Rocky Mountains and grew up as a real outdoorsy kid. Went off to Vail, was selling posters in a little health food store there, kind of following the events of the 60s and, you know, the March on Washington and the Democratic Convention and all of that. And he started to go off and pick herbs in the mountains and realized that you could make really good tea with this. And it was very different than the Lipton teas and the black teas of the world, which dominated the market at that point. So he had no idea how to create a business. None of these natural prophets did. And he moved to Boulder and hooked up with a couple of people that he thought would be able to help him. And at one point, he goes into a bank with his business plan, and he tells them he's going to build a $100 million business. He just needs to start out with a $10,000 loan. And he brings in Tupperware containers of his fragrant herbs and what have you. And they're sitting in the bank manager's office, which is his glass-walled office. And the bank manager is very cordial and asks them to hold on and says, would it be okay if I brought in some of my colleagues because I'd like them to hear your story too? And they say, good. And a couple of minutes later, there's other three-piece suitors in the room, and they're listening to Mo Siegel and his colleague, and they shake hands and they leave. And as Mo is leaving the bank, he looks back up at this glass office and he sees them all laughing hysterically. Because he realizes that this was just a big joke to them.
Yeah, I wonder if they're laughing now.
No, of course, Celestial went on to become Hain Celestial, and they are on the manufacturing side of the natural foods industry what Whole Foods is on the retail side. They own everybody. And they are a dominant force.
Yeah, and what was the breakthrough moment from them when they started being able? I mean, after they were able to figure out distribution and that kind of thing. One of the things that you mention in the book is that their packaging was so much better than anyone had done in that industry beforehand. Can you talk about that a little?
Yes, very true. I liken the packaging breakthrough of Celestial Seasonings to that moment in The Wizard of Oz when we land in Oz and it goes from black and white to Technicolor. Because the health food stores of the 60s were really drab affairs. I mean, all the food was brown.
And the packaging was brown butcher paper and brown bags.
If that. A lot of it was, as I say, it was just sort of this bulk bins. And the reason for that was obvious, because this was a fledgling industry. They weren't going to waste any money on packaging and marketing. They just wanted to get it right from the farm into the store. But Celestial saw it differently. And this was really Mo Siegel's baby. And he created packages right from the start, very similar to what you see today for Celestial. Vivid colors, beautiful illustrations, philosophical sayings on the side of them. And his view was that if you could create packaging that attracted people into the store, and then they happened to discover after that, hey, this product really tastes good, then you could cross over from the fringe natural foods customers into the mainstream. And that's exactly what happened. Celestial, along with a couple of other products like Tom's of Maine and Frookies was an interesting one that I tell about in the book. These were among the very first products that had been born on the natural and organic side that did start to appear on the mainstream shelves of the Smiths and Safeways and Albertsons of the world.
So once the industry discovered the power of distribution networks and marketing and packaging, did that lay the seeds for them to take off?
A little bit, but it really still took some outside forces. And one of those happened 25 years ago this month, which, again, if you think about it, not really all that long ago. But in February of 1989, a report from the National Resources Defense Council had come out about the chemical agent ALAR. ALAR, which was widely used on fruits and in particular on apples back in the day. And the report said that it was a possible carcinogen, and they actually enumerated how many school children they thought could die as a result of ingesting apples and apple products with ALAR, which they pegged at 6,000. And this was a very frightening event. Which was magnified by the fact that on February 26th of 1989, 60 Minutes ran a piece about it, very controversial piece.
Isn't
and that was followed
steep.
A couple of months later by a big article in Newsweek that was called Panic for Organic. And that's what happened. It was, in a very short order, a media blitz that created fear, and that galvanized a lot of the efforts that the people like Mo Siegel and Gene Kahn and John Mackey had been working on diligently, but pretty much out of view up until that point. And now you started to get it. Now you started to see mainstream America really understand for the first time what had happened to their food products and some of the risks that, that we were all now facing.
Can you talk about John Mackey?
Sure.
You could go on and on about him. Yeah, the big supermarkets now are what I presume Whole Foods is the largest, but maybe Sprouts is catching up.
Yeah, I mean, Whole Foods started in 1980, so they had quite a head start, and they're an amazing company. I mean, they're number 232 on the Fortune 500 list right now. They're the eighth largest public food and drug company in the United States, which really is amazing when you think about where they started and what they were selling. Sprouts started much more recently, in 2002, and their stores are smaller, and they're kind of more hybrid stores that offer some conventional foods as well as a lot of natural organic foods. But John is really one of the major focuses of the book. He was a fascinating guy to work for, and I'm really glad that I had that opportunity. He was somebody who, he's got a really facile mind. He's a very competitive guy, very intellectual guy. But he had dropped out of college several times, never earned a degree, just sort of wandered and found himself in Austin and in the natural foods industry, such as it was. But he had a vision. And unlike the rest of the natural foods retailers of the day, which were companies like New Frontiers in Salt Lake City or Mrs. Gooch's in Los Angeles or Bread and Circus in Boston, which were all regional players and never really saw beyond that, John had this vision, and he alone looked into the future and thought that natural foods really could become a force, not just in the food industry, but influencing all industry. And that what needed to happen was that you needed to educate customers about what the differences were and why it was important and perhaps worthwhile to spend a few more pennies on natural and organic products. He created a system in Whole Foods that, gosh, to my knowledge, it's really unlike any other Fortune 500 company out there because it's so decentralized. They push the power in the company out to the furthest reaches, so that the individual managers in a deli department in the Cottonwood Heights store can make decisions that are affecting her or his department, and not have to take orders from the central office in Austin. And as big as Whole Foods has become, I guess they're probably near about $12 billion right now, that system has not broken down. They've been able to hire a very motivated workforce and make everybody feel like they're running their own business. So that's really kind of the major reason I think that Whole Foods has become so iconic and so successful. And, you know, they've been parodied on The Simpsons. I can't think of any honor that's greater than that.
Yeah, talk about the cost though of organic food. Has the industry convinced Americans that they have to pay more to get this kind of food? I would think maybe naively that if you're not highly processing something, it really ought to cost less. And
yeah, doesn't it seem that way?
And yet people know that they're going to pay more for their cart of groceries in a natural food store, and quite a bit more sometimes.
That's right. Yeah, I mean, as a marketer, when I was running marketing for Whole Foods and Sprouts and writing ads, I would often turn to a line very similar to the one that you just used and say, wouldn't you think that with all of those extra ingredients in a conventional food, that it would cost more? But it doesn't, because they're just cheap fillers. They've taken a lot of the real food out, and they've substituted it with other things. In fact, I tell a story in the book about a product that was developed in the 60s called Merlinex, and it was called by its manufacturer Instant Anything, because it could be sort of used to create phony fig paste in fig bars, or imitation strawberry filling, or brownie texturizer, or Colby cheese. Really, really cheap ingredients instead of using the more expensive natural ingredients. So, yeah, I mean, your question is an excellent one. And I think to this day, the answer is no. I don't think we've been able to fully convince the American public that spending those extra dollars is the right trade-off for them, because at this point, natural and organic foods, with the pendulum having swung from our grandparents' generation when it was 100% or nearly 100% to the post-World War era when it was almost eliminated, to now, we're only back at about maybe 6% of all food is natural and organic. Now, it's still growing very, very fast. It's projected to double by the end of this decade. And with scale, the prices have come down, and in many cases, they are nearing parity with the conventional counterparts. So that's a good sign. And I think the last number I saw was something like 83% of families in the United States at least sometimes buy organic foods.
Yeah, I think the grocery business is kind of notoriously they operate on very thin profit margins. Do the natural food purveyors get a higher profit margin because they're charging more?
They do have a slightly higher profit margin, but it's still a pretty thin one. So, you know, in Park City, you've got a store like Fairweather Natural Foods, which is just a little one-off store that doesn't have the scale and the buying power that a Whole Foods does or Sprouts does. And the only way they can survive is to charge prices that are a little bit more, because that sustains their operations and their higher customer service and their labor levels and things like that. These bigger chains like a Whole Foods or a Sprouts or a Earth Fair or some other ones around the country have been able to rectify that situation a little bit. You know, one thing to keep in mind is that there is, at this point, still no definition, no federal definition from the FDA about what is a natural food, much as there was no definition for what was an organic food for many, many years until 1990, when the Organic Food Production Act was finally passed, and it wasn't implemented actually until 2002. So up until that point in the organic world, states had their own laws, and you could see, you'd go into a Fairweather Natural Foods, and on the shelf you might see right next to each other, side by side, something that said that it was California organic, something that said that it was Colorado organic, and something that said that it was Pennsylvania organic, and they all meant different things. And so that, understandably, made consumers very suspicious that maybe this organic stuff was just a marketing ploy for raising the retails. Eventually, we got the national standardization that we needed so that organic meant the same thing everywhere. And I think that contributed to a much greater level of confidence and a higher faith in consumers that they were getting a product that was superior in value and that was worth forking over a little bit of extra money for. And now natural is probably heading in that same direction. There's a consensus for what it means in the marketplace, but I think that there's some consumer skepticism, and understandably so. So if the FDA does begin to move on that, and if we are able to continue to show consumers out there that this is better for them, it's better for the planet, it's better for the people who are making the foods, then I do think you'll see the scale that is necessary, and hopefully we will reach that point at which there really is no cost premium.
Hey, I'm going to ask one last quick question because we're running out of time, and maybe, I know it wouldn't have a quick answer, but try to make it one, and that is, are some additives good? I mean, should, you know, I just think of last year of 17 or 18 people dying and from eating Colorado cantaloupes and E. coli and food and so on. Can a case be made that some additives are good?
Sure. I think that in raising livestock, there are times when you want to have some drugs at your disposal to be able to help the animals. And I think in combating weeds and pests and things like that, there are additives, preservatives, fungicides, things like that, that can be very helpful and find the right balance between health and economics. But keep in mind, there are many, many natural versions of those. And in fact, even under the federal organic law, there are permissible substances that help with all of those things without having to resort to all of the miracles of the laboratory and the synthetic additives. So, I'm very optimistic about where we are right now, given where we've been. And I think the folks who are listening to a show like yours, who are have a lot of financial acumen, can understand that there's a difference in the products that we're offering out there.
Well, that's a great way to end this conversation. It's really fascinating. We've been talking to Joe Dobro, the author of Natural Profits, From Health Foods to Whole Foods, How the Pioneers of the Industry Changed the Way We Eat and Reshaped American Business.
That has to be the longest subtitle for a book we've had yet.
Wasn't my choice. Just Natural Profits.
Okay. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Yes.
Larry, Beth, thanks for having me on. It was really a pleasure.
Okay, thanks.
Bye-bye.
This is KPCW Park City.